mechanical way, reacting to external demands or instruction rather than in ways determined by his own interests and energies and power. He says we may admire what he does, but we despise what he is. For Humboldt, then, man is born to inquire and create. And when a man or a child chooses to inquire or create out of his own free choice, then he becomes in his own terms an artist rather than a tool of production or a well-trained parent.
Hello and welcome to the 102nd episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. This week, the philosopher and psychoanalyst Adrian Johnston returns to discuss his book, Badu, Zizek, and Political Transformations. It was a conversation that lasted just about 2 hours, so this episode will be part one of a two-part examination of the act, the event, and how to strive for both. It's Thursday, May 5th, 2011. I'm Douglas Lane, the host of the Diet Soap Podcast, and Osama bin Laden is still dead.
Our top story tonight.
Our top story tonight.
Francisco Franco is still dead. Good night and have a pleasant tomorrow.
The Pick Your Battle Guide to Urban Foraging, Critical Theory, and Groping Towards a Praxis is still available to everyone who donates $6 or more to the podcast. And I want to thank Andrew M., Sammy R., Richard B., and James L. for making a donation to the podcast and let you all know that the book will be coming your way soon. The book is designed and laid out. All that's left to get is an ISBN number and then get the files to the printer. I expect that by the 104th episode of Diet Soap, the book will be either in your hands or definitely jetting your way. For those of you who didn't contribute to the writing of the book through Kickstarter, nor donate to the podcast to pre-order, but who would like to, that donate button is at dietsoap.podomatic.com, or you can find it over at the dietsoapcast.com blog, or go to my writing blog, which is douglaslane.com, and find the PayPal button there. I should also implore you all to follow me on Twitter under the name Doug Lane, to find me on Facebook, that's Douglas Lane, L-A-I-N, in Portland, Oregon, to find the Facebook community page for Diet Soap, or to simply let me implant a chip in your brain so I can send you a secret signal and direct your each and every thought. Oh, come on, please. The music you're hearing right now is The Bad Plus covering the Tears for Fears song, Everybody Wants to Rule the World. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Professor Adrian Johnston and I discuss how to act in case of an event. Adrian Johnston is a professor of philosophy at the University of New Mexico at Albuquerque and an assistant teaching analyst at the Emory Psychoanalytic Institute in Atlanta. He is the author of Time Driven, Zizek's Ontology, and the book we'll be talking about today, which is Badu, Zizek, and Political Transformations. This is Professor Johnston's second appearance on the podcast. And again, Adrian, thank you very much for coming back on the podcast.
And thank you for having me.
You know, I sent you some sample questions, and I'm glad you took a look at them. I expect that some other questions will come up as we go along, but I'd like to start with one that I didn't send you, but I think might serve as a way to set up how our conversation will be different from other kinds of political conversations that's often heard on the left. It's not even really a question. It's more that I have this quote from Zizek, and I thought I'd ask you to kind of respond to it. And Zizek often will repeat this story about a friend of his going to meet Noam Chomsky, the most influential public intellectual in America. Here's a quote. It says, "My friend told me that Chomsky said something very sad. He said that today we don't need theory. All we need to do is tell people empirically what is going on. Here I violently disagree. Facts are facts, and they are precious, but they can work in this way or that way. Facts alone are not enough. You have to change the ideological background. So I guess today we're going to discuss changing that background, but before we start, we could just expand, or you could just expand a bit about this distinction between Chomsky and Zizek. Obviously, both of them want to change the system we live in, but they have a different view maybe of what the system is. Or
well, I think that there are a number of things going on that with the anecdotes that Zizek deploys, I think that they tend to be very well chosen because they are these points of condensation for a number of different things that link up with an array of components of his approach to both philosophy and politics. To begin with, of course, you know, Chomsky is not someone who self-identifies with the tradition of Marxist political philosophy in the way that Zizek does. And, of course, Zizek's story brings this out, where for Chomsky, this is not at all to question his committed leftist credentials. I mean, he certainly, I think, you know, should not be disparaged. But I do think that, you know, coming from an approach such as Zizek does, that involves, for example, if you go back to a classic in the Western Marxist tradition, Georg Lukács, is History and Class Consciousness from 1923. I think Lukács does a very good job of pointing out how the very notion of a fact is something which ultimately is a bone of contention between Marxism on the one hand and a whole array of other approaches. And with Zizek, you not only have that sort of Hegelian and Marxist suspicion of the very concept of what a fact is and the emphasis on how facts themselves are constituted on the basis of, you know, a whole surrounding framework that refracts, inflects, mediates, tonalizes these quote-unquote facts in decisive ways. And with Zizek in particular, it's something that's very distinctive about his project that I think is involved in this way he has of responding to Chomsky, is that starting with his very first book in English, 1989's Sublime Object of Ideology, one of the problems that Zizek is confronting is something that, and here's where he adds, I think, a very decisive new twist to the Marxist conception of ideology that Marx himself doesn't lay out and you know, doesn't really indicate on his radar in the 19th century. And it's what Zizek calls cynical distance. You know, think about how there are certain quote-unquote facts that we all readily acknowledge. You know, people across the mainstream political spectrum in America will agree that it's a fact, for instance, that you know, money has, you know, decisively corrupted legislative politics in the U.S., that lobbies have a disproportionate influence, that politicians generally end up just serving the interests of their backers and donors, et cetera, et cetera. And what Zizek is struck by is the fact that everybody knows this. Everybody is aware of this as a fact. And yet we still continue to act as if the system wasn't inherently corrupt, wasn't contaminated and compromised in such a fashion as to render it a farce, etc. And so I think for him, Chomsky is a bit naive in thinking that it's the old Enlightenment faith and know the truth and the truth will set you free, that if people are cognizant of these things, that will automatically result in a change of behavior in a different form of social conduct. And for Zizek, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that we can be you know, cynically enlightened and say, yes, I know that this is a sham, but nonetheless continue to participate in it. Right, so he feels that Chomsky doesn't really rise to that challenge. I do think that it's a difference between Chomsky's traditional Enlightenment faith in the transformative power of merely knowing the truth and Zizek's awareness informed by psychoanalysis that you can have an intellectual acceptance of the repressed that doesn't result in any decisive transformation in terms of one's socially efficacious conduct.
Well, you know, this week on my podcast, I had a conversation with a philosophy professor in South Korea on the subject of analytic philosophy versus continental philosophy. And I wonder if Chomsky's approach might be more in line with the analytic tradition.
I think so. Even though, you know, with Chomsky, you really get the sense of there being, you know, a hard and fast distinction between the work that he's done in linguistics and analytic philosophy of language on the one hand, and then his political writings on the other. With Žižek, you know, you also, there seems to be a difference between his more strictly philosophical works and his interventions at the level of politics, and especially with respect to current events. But with Žižek, you can much more clearly see the intertwining of what he is doing with the resources of German idealism, Marxism, and psychoanalysis at the level of philosophical theory, and the way that he intervenes in controversies about, you know, ongoing struggles in the political and social fields. Whereas with Chomsky, I do think that, you know, there's a break between those works, but the one thing that might, you know, nonetheless link them would be that an Anglo-American analytic approach, someone trained in that sort of tradition, up until quite recently, your sense of the history of philosophy went up through the Immanuel Kant of the analytic philosopher P.F. Strawson with his interpretation of Kant, and then leapt over everything else in the 19th century and landed at the end of that century in the turn of the 20th with Frege, Russell, Wittgenstein, and company. And that the development of dialectics with Hegel, Marxist materialism, and the historical materialist approach to issues in political economy, the whole range of resources that someone like Žižek deploys is just not a part of the formation of somebody trained in analytic philosophy, at least, you know, especially someone of Chomsky's age.
Right. Well, even I, who went to university in the 90s, when I took philosophy classes, the history of philosophy went up through Kant, and then after that you had your choice of, like, could you take a course on Wittgenstein? You can take a course on Russell. I mean,
yes, that's
really,
right.
And I had no idea that I was being indoctrinated.
But believe it or not, that gap between Kant at the end of the 18th century and then the you know, end of the 19th, turn of the 20th century, in that gap subsists all of this crucial material that I think is, I mean, one can really, I think, even though it's a bit of an oversimplification, one could argue that really the proper name Hegel stands for the point of divergence, the split that has, you know, of course, congealed into this division between analytic and continental camps in, you know, in Western philosophy today.
Let's talk about your book, Badu, Žižek, and Political Transformations. It seems like a book that right now is particularly significant. It seems like right now we're living in a moment where, at least a month or so ago, we were given a prime example of what an event is and what the act is, and we're in the Middle East and in Northern Africa, the coordinates of the ideological coordinates are seemingly moving around and are open to question. So your book, Badu, Žižek, and Political Transformation, seems more significant and important than ever. I'm not sure to what extent that kind of thinking is really going on in the English-speaking world, but maybe we can start the ball rolling. Your book juxtaposes the politics of two philosophers, Badu and Žižek. And while many left philosophers focus on kind of gaps in capitalism or the interstitial spaces and differences that are inside this system, Žižek and Badu both attempt to challenge the basis of the whole social field. And this way they are totalitarian. You begin your book with Benjamin's Angel of History, an essay he wrote as a description of a Paul Klee painting called Angel Novus. And you suggest that the American left, and really maybe the world's left, is looking back on the 20th century and the failures of really existing socialism from the same perspective as this angel in the painting. And Benjamin writes that this angel's face is turned toward the past, where he perceives, where it's...
His story is an angel being blown backwards into the future. He said his story is a pile of debris, and the angel wants to go back and fix things, to repair the things that have been broken. But there is a storm blowing from Paris, and the storm keeps blowing the angel backwards. into the future. And this story is called
Are Badu and Zizek looking back from the same perspective as the angel? And if so, how have they avoided this kind of general anemia and kind of hopeless feeling of that come after 1989 and the collapse of, or earlier with Stalinism, the collapse of socialism, really existing socialism?
I chose to dwell at length on Benjamin's thesis on the philosophy of history in the preface to the book, in part because Benjamin achieves an amazing degree of compression through this very literary, almost poetic writing style. In the span of a few pages, he condenses so much of what is really at stake in terms of competing possible perspectives within the left. And I feel that in many ways, revisiting that text by Benjamin allows for an appreciation of some of what both Badiou and Zizek are themselves struggling with, just as Benjamin was at the end of the 1930s. And of course, you know, Benjamin writes this piece, he pens this essay, largely as a response to Stalin's 1938 booklet, Dialectical and Historical Materialism, which of course ended up being imposed upon the really existing socialist world, at least, you know, the Soviet sphere, as the orthodox theoretical view of that sort of leftism. And of course, what you have expressed by Stalin there is this, you know, crude, vulgarized version of Marxism that presents it as a kind of secular theodicy, with the notion that history moves according to laws which Marx reveals thanks to his historical materialism, and that we can scientifically discern and predict how things are developing, and that we can support with absolute certainty our position, you know, we the party under Stalin, that you know, we are acting directly as the agent of history with a capital H in terms of its general arc or logic, and so on and so forth. And of course, this was expressive of, I mean, it's a certain crude version of a Hegelianized Marxism that takes the progressive, the optimism and historical progress that you have in the Enlightenment that Hegel inherits in his own way, and that Marx also soaks up in part through Hegel, and, you know, redeploying it in the 20th century. And of course, for those who are not critical of traditional Marxism in relation to the shifting terrain of the 20th century, Stalin's version seems incredibly, you know, crude and indefensible. And you have, even before Benjamin, you have, for example, Gramsci already retooling Marxism in the 1920s and 1930s based on an awareness that, well, new things have happened. The developments in history after Marx are not unfolding in the way that, you know, the more classical model would have predicted. And in certain respects, we need to go back to the drawing board, right? I mean, Gramsci witnesses the Great Depression and sees this doesn't shake Western capitalism to its very foundations. It survives. It endures. It managed to make it through a crisis that the traditional Marxist model would have predicted would result in mass-scale social unrest, etc. But Stalin ends up redeploying this 19th century, again, secular theodicy. And Benjamin, whereas, you know, some Marxists in the 20th century go in a direction of a real dystopianism and a complete rejection of any kind of optimism and historical progress. For example, Adorno's pessimism, this outlook according to which, no, in fact, we're moving in the wrong direction rather than the right direction. We can have no confidence in redemption being possible in the foreseeable future in terms of the arc of history. Benjamin, I think, is trying to strike a very delicate balance here, and not in the face of things like the endurance of capitalism, the rise of European fascism, Stalin's triumph in the USSR, all of these setbacks. Benjamin is trying to find a way to, on the one hand, attenuate the old optimism of history is on our side and will inevitably carry us to the shores of socialism and on into a radically egalitarian communist society. He wants to abandon what would be a strong messianism of this secular theodicy that you have in 19th century thinking, but without lapsing into the other extreme, which would be a kind of resigned pessimism, a sort of dystopian outlook, according to which we're basically going downhill and are doomed, and that the left is just going to face catastrophe after catastrophe, setback after setback. And what Benjamin calls his weak messianism is this attempt at this balance where, on the one hand, yes, there are these series of defeats, but there are perhaps the possibility in the future of unforeseen retroactive redemptions of those past defeats, but they're not guaranteed, that we can't just confidently sit back and be complacent and assured that the hand of history will carry us in the directions that we want to be moving in. And I think both Badiou and Žižek are trying to strike that same sort of balance between overconfidence and underconfidence that already, I think, in 1940, you know, Benjamin is attempting to pinpoint or establish as the terrain which a 20th century Marxist would have to occupy. And I think that even in the early 21st century, this holds. And I think Badiou and Žižek are both attempting that kind of Benjaminian balance in their own ways.
What I notice here is that the storm that's brewing is brewing in or is blowing in paradise.
Yes.
And it's not the destruction on earth that's pushing the angel, but the storm in paradise. And so that storm maybe is not wholly connected to the wreckage upon wreckage that is hurling itself in front of our feet. Do you read that into?
Absolutely. When you think of the story of Lenin, who once his revolution in October 1917, once it succeeded at lasting a day longer than the Paris Commune of 1871, you know, ran out and danced in the snow in the middle of a Moscow winter, right? And I think that this idea of 1917 as the, you know, as the redemption of 1871, I think that, you know, of course, with the idea that the storm is blowing from paradise, is that, yes, there are these setbacks, there are these, in some cases, horrible, crushing, demoralizing defeats suffered by the left. But it's that without that string of losses, that it, in a way, it's possible, but not guaranteed. It's possible that in the future it will have been the case, you know, in this future anterior mode of retroaction, that those apparent catastrophes indeed were prognostications, in a way, catalytic precursors of a future redemption to come. And I think that what both Badiou and Žižek are trying to do with respect to really existing socialism, which is part of what your question asked about, yeah, and this notion of the enemy that's being referred to is the disorder and then collapse that happened toward the end of the 1980s that brought down the Berlin Wall, etc., that both of them, I think, are wanting to say, well, look, we are not going to be ideologically blackmailed by the political center in the West into repudiating this as nothing more than the inevitable disaster that results when you try and be too radical, that it always ends up being totalitarianism, that you'll have the Gulag or the concentration camp and, you know, these horrors and failures as the, safely predictable outcome whenever there's an attempt at this kind of radical egalitarian politics. They also, of course, both refuse to use the term totalitarianism, since it tends to be a means of lumping together fascism and communism, and they both resist that as an ideologically loaded gesture. But for them, something Žižek has taken to saying recently is, it's time for us on the far left to stop apologizing for 20th century really existing socialism. The notion that forever after, all we can do is just say, well, we were wrong, we can't, you know, hold to what we held to before because look at how badly it turned out when there was an attempt to implement it, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the time, you know, and of course, it's to refuse that, refuse to be put in the position of, all right, all we can do on the radical left is, you know, basically try and modify our stance while endlessly apologizing for the excesses of the 20th century. But both Badiou and Žižek are aware that, well, if we're to repeat communism, if we're going to attempt to reactualize it, this is not going to be a mere repetition or a simple redeployment of the same, that indeed it will have to be reinvented, that radical leftism does have to be reinvented, but we can do so in a way that nonetheless involves remaining faithful to some of its core commitments rather than being, you know, ideologically bullied and blackmailed into abandoning that because of what use can be made by the opponents of radical leftism, what use can be made by them of what happened under people like Stalin.
Again, 20th century communism is over. And we should be the first to criticize it. You know, like, for me, the problem with liberal anti-communists is they don't even have a really good theory. It's still an enigma. What went so terribly wrong? My God, it started as a good revolution. It turned into a terror which was even worse than fascism sometimes.
Yeah.
So no continuity here. I don't have any nostalgia, but nonetheless it wasn't so bad. It ended in a total catastrophe. 20th century communism was a mega catastrophe. Things were terribly broken. We should not think in these terms, you know, it's nostalgic, oh, the same struggles will go on. No, it's different,
Bill S. Preston, Esquire, and Ted Theodore Logan. Gentlemen, I'm here to help you with your history report.
What? Strange things are afoot at the Circle K.
I mean, the thing about both of these guys, Badu and Žižek, is that they both philosophize on the possibility of a radical break still being possible, even in the face of the catastrophes of the 20th century. And as Marxists, they do this as Hegelians, right? Can we take a look here at their Hegelianism and maybe the similarities and differences between their interpretation of Hegel?
Yes, and I actually think that this marks a real difference between the two of them, because in fact I would say it's only Žižek whose Marxism is a Hegelianized Marxism. And in this respect, Žižek, I think, is much more of a classical or traditional Marxist than is Badiou. You know, of course, Badiou began his intellectual career in his youth as a French Maoist, but he has since moved in different directions without apologizing for that, without recanting in the way that a lot of ex-Maoists like Bernard Kouchner, etc., ended up doing and turning himself into an acceptable, even center right, or a lot of the pop philosophers well known in France, but not in the English speaking world, are repentant ex-Maoists who repudiated the leftism of the youth. Badiou hasn't done that, but he, unlike Žižek, he holds Hegel very much at arm's length. And the way that I could formulate the difference between the two of them, apropos the Hegel-Marx relationship, is that whereas they're both, as I said a few minutes ago, like Benjamin, trying to achieve this very tricky balance between an excess and a deficit of confidence in the trajectory of socio-historical developments, along the lines of Benjamin's weak messianism. Žižek, especially as of late, take his three most recent works that deal with politics, In Defense of Lost Causes, First is Tragedy, Then is Farce, and Living in the End Times. One of the things that's interesting is that he's going back to the old Marxist notion of revolutionary developments of the punctuated equilibrium of social history as being driven by tensions between the infrastructure, the economic base on the one hand, and its corresponding superstructural frameworks or envelopes. And Žižek is wanting to argue that certain things like issues having to do with ecology, with information technology, with immigration and the way in which people are distributed between certain slum zones, areas not under government control, and then other parts of the world that can be radically different in terms of level of development, etc., that he is arguing, he's sort of reviving the classical Hegelian Marxist argument that certain tension between infrastructure and superstructure is the dialectical motor that will eventually precipitate out of itself certain revolutionary transformations. And he's wanting to say, look, we can see that there are these fault lines of tension that are part of the global sociopolitical terrain today that hold the potential, perhaps not guarantee, but at least hold out the promise that radical upheaval or instability is in the cards in the near future, right? Whereas Badiou, going back to his 1982 book Theory of the Subject, which came out a few years ago in English translation, has consistently argued that, as he summarizes it in a Lacan-style one-liner, history does not exist, and this is history with a capital H. Right, and Badiou wants to claim contra what he takes to be, and you know what is usually taken to be in terms of the textbook interpretation of Hegel, Hegel's view of history as an intelligible totality, as a single massive arc or trajectory of movement, whose basic fundamental logic can be with the benefit of hindsight, the backward glance of the philosopher can discern, is able to put his finger on the living pulse of history as it runs through various times and places. And Badiou wants to say that no, there's no underlying unifying fundamental logic, basic single arc or trajectory as the core line that one could trace as history with a capital H in the singular. And he wants to say all you have are just different, irreducible, separate histories, small h plural, that involve these post-eventual sequences that are incommensurable with each other, right? So Badiou has a much more fragmented vision of history as just a series of lowercase h histories, whereas Zizek, I think, is flirting now with re-embracing the 19th century Hegelian Marxism that seemed so problematic for most of the 20th century because of subsequent twists and turns of history that led most Marxist thinkers in Western Europe in the 20th century to repudiate this. And so in a way, Zizek is now much more of a kind of, if you wanted to put it in terms of the two centuries, he is, I think, interested in going back to the 19th century and revisiting it in light of the early 21st century, whereas Badiou, I think, is a little more faithful to some of the changes that were worked out in Marxist and post-Marxist thinking in the 20th century that involved taking some distance from what's considered to be the kind of Hegelian secular theodicy of history with a capital H.
Sounds like Badiou is more of a post-Marxist than Zizek, who may be leaning towards returning to actual straight-ahead Marxism.
That's right. That's right. And they also, on the economy, you can see this very clearly, too, in that Zizek still wants to argue that there is a degree of priority to be attributed to what happens at the economic level in terms of the infrastructural base as conceived of by Marx and his followers, whereas Badiou has made clear that he does not think that there is any kind of primacy to the economic level in terms of the dynamics of socio-historical movement.
I recently listened to a French theorist talk about Marx's 11 thesis on Feuerbach. I wonder if it almost sounds to me like Badiou is more of a strict Feuerbachian and Zizek is siding with Marx. Now, this doesn't mean anything to people who haven't read Feuerbach or know the story, but the story is Feuerbach says, in a nutshell, that men project their best aspects onto heaven and onto God, and that the trick is to reclaim our own powers. And Marx wants to correct Feuerbach. And the correction is a subtle one, I think, and those theses, and I'm not sure I have a full grasp on it, but I think from a Zizekian perspective or a Lacanian perspective, the contradiction in the humanity is vital to understand, that you can't just claim that power that you project on the God. That projection is a part of your power. Would that be the Hegelian difference between Badiou and Zizek?
There are several ways to approach this, and I should begin by saying, and this is a bit funny, I can't resist, and hopefully this doesn't come across as horribly shameless self-promotion, but a book that I have that's under review right now, and that hopefully I'll be getting things solidified with my publisher, Northwestern University Press, soon, I've entitled Alain Badiou and the Outcome of Contemporary French Philosophy, with reference to Engels' 1888 text, Ludwig Feuerbach and the Outcome of Classical German Philosophy, casting Badiou in the role of Feuerbach, who, on the one hand, Marx and Engels readily recognize as a crucial mediator between themselves and Hegel, and that Feuerbach's critique of Christianity, his materialist inversion of Hegelian idealism, etc., for both Marx and Engels was a decisive influence on them in their development, and that they are willing to give credit where credit is due, despite, of course, at the same time emphasizing the crucial limitations to Feuerbach's materialist inversion of Hegel. And One of the points that came up in the question you asked, you know, has to do with the difference between Badiou and Žižek in terms of how they view human beings, or what we might very loosely call, with scare quotes, caveats and qualifications attached, human nature. And with Badiou, you have this mobilization of, and in fact, Badiou does, you know, both Badiou and Žižek, since Feuerbach is, of course, very concerned with critiquing Christianity, that both Badiou and Žižek appropriate and redeploy the language of Christianity in certain elements of that religious tradition. Badiou published in French in 97 this book on St. Paul, which has gone on to become very influential. Žižek is interested in this kind of Hegelian imminent critique of Christianity that reveals it to be the religion of atheism, etc. But Badiou has very aggressively redeployed some of this language and talks about the difference between, on the one hand, the human animal, the sorts of beings that we are when we're just fully embedded in and going with the flow of the established status quo. And then there's the possibility, though, that we can be shattered by encountering an event, some sort of rupture that derails the normal run of things for us, and in response to that event, break in our being, we are transubstantiated into these immortal subjects, where we are more than human, where we transcend our mere finite animality with its very mundane desires and interests. And for Žižek, as well as for myself, Badiou has too sharp a split, and a non-dialecticized one to boot, between the human animal on the one hand and the inhuman immortal subject on the other. And both Žižek and I are interested in working out accounts of, you might say, the being of human beings that allows for, I think, a much more subtle and defensible account of some of the distinctions that Badiou lays out in too stark and sharp a form, that doesn't allow for understanding that what makes possible this kind of transubstantiation, or how we might not be necessarily evental subjects but still not be fully complicit with an established status quo or given order. There are these sorts of issues lurking in the background. There are also, with Feuerbach, and of course Marx's big complaint about Feuerbachian materialism, as well as before 18th century French materialism, is that this sort of materialism is merely contemplative. In other words, it just looks at what's supposed to be some sort of natural material essence of human beings and describes that. But when you render human beings in this way, where they are just static objects to be observed in the same way that we would observe, say, the bits of matter in motion that the natural sciences look at, you leave aside, you don't have a materialist account of the processes of practice that human beings engage in, which result in them changing not only their surroundings, but themselves in the process, that Marx's whole dialectic of subject and object in terms of the activity of labor can't be accounted for by something like Feuerbachian materialism, because it just speaks in terms of ahistorical nature and these fixed essences, albeit of a material sort, which are the supposed truth of humanity, that once we recognize, we'll no longer be tempted into religious alienation, projecting our human nature, beyond ourselves into some supersensible heaven, et cetera, et cetera. And so a materialistic kind of practice, of course, is crucial for Marx, which he thinks no prior materialism has, right? Transformative practice is not something he sees that prior materialism is able to do justice to. And in that sense, both Badiou and Žižek too, Badiou as well, I think he is trying to develop an account of practice in relation to his theory of the event that rises to that sort of challenge.
Well, I'm reminded when you talk about Badiou's desire to have this event that will transform us from our animal being, which from Badiou's way of thinking, I think, is our social everyday kind of being.
Yes.
And to transform us from that into some sort of immortal, heroic figures, not just as individuals, but collectively, we could all be maybe under the event transformed. Last night, I watched the movie, an old movie called Altered States, and William Hurt plays a scientist who's seeking the divine through sensory deprivation and drugs and all of that. as he goes into his mystical states, he becomes more and more animalistic. The notion of the divine is all wrapped up in our ancestral past and the understanding of our materiality. And so in the end, he ends up, I mean, as an ape at one point, and then, I don't know, as a protozoa or something.
Yeah.
So the more divine he tries to be, the more primitive, primal, materialistic, animalistic he becomes.
Yeah.
So that seems to me dialectical somehow. And for me, it was also kind of a letdown. I hadn't seen the movie in a while, and I just thought, this movie really, it philosophically misses its mark. But
But
it's interesting nonetheless.
I think both Badu and Zizek would have the same reaction you did too, that they would both feel it misses the mark as well.
Right. But I think maybe Badu would be more susceptible to falling for the same trap as Altered States, that break or division between the divine and the animalistic is maybe too clear-cut in Badu's case. Is that right?
Yes. I do think so. Although, you know, for example, going back to, you know, the opening of your question, that one of the things that is very helpful about Badiou's theory of subjectivity, the way that he defines subject, which is quite specific, it's peculiar to his philosophy. It's certainly not a standard orthodox conception of subjectivity judged against the use of that term in the modern Western philosophical tradition. One of the things, you talked about, the possibility of us collectively becoming something like this. And that's, of course, crucial for Badiou. For him, subjectivity is not something which is synonymous with, my individual personhood, in terms of my specific, first-person conscious or self-conscious position, et cetera. He, of course, has these four, what he calls the four generic procedures of truth production, which are the, you might say the areas and practices that give rise to the truths which then philosophy contemplates. He speaks, of course, art, science, politics, and love as these four domains. This is very kind of classically Platonic of him. But for Badiou, when you talk about, for instance, an artistic subject, well, an artistic subject for him is not the self-aware individual producer, that an artistic subject is a body of works, either by an individual artist or even by a whole artistic movement, right, that you could speak of, like a subject of cubism, for instance. And, of course, in love, for him, the subject there is not one or the other of the partners in the couple, but rather is some sort of third that is constructed in between the two who are brought together in the amorous tie. And in politics, for him, there's a subject of politics that's most definitely not an individual. It is a kind of collective manifestation that has a certain coherence and force.
For Badiou, one way to look at love be that, like, to examine courtly love as opposed to romantic love?
He's very dismissive of certain traditional models like courtly love. And in fact, for him, even romantic love, he would have probably a few reservations. He'd say, well, it very much depends on what you mean by that phrase. But for him, there's a way in which each couple, this relationship arises thanks to an amorous event, an event in terms of unforeseen, unpredictable, not guaranteed to happen encounter, that then you decide that you are going to remain in certain ways faithful to. And you begin this process of, if we put it in very non-technical terms, building a life together with someone else who you are committed to in this fidelity to the fact that you met, that you had this encounter, and that it meant something, and you want to affirm that. And for Badiou, each pair, a couple has to, in a sense, invent a way of being together that is specific to them, forge their own particular amorous universe that is not just about emotion, but, is more importantly even about a set of practices, a way of putting one foot in front of the other together, sharing one's practical affairs, etc., that is going to be idiosyncratic. For Badiou, there's going to be an irreducible newness if it's really love and is not just marital cohabitation, for instance. is going to be you are literally having to, you can't rely upon stale social norms. You can't just simply import preconceptions into it. You've got to reinvent together from scratch, in a way, a new kind of universe that is, you know, a kind of subjectivity that you both constructed that is neither, it's not reducible to either one of you or just to the two of you taken together. It's something which is a third product of your being together.
So he believes in a certain kind of authenticity. You know, a cynic would say, oh, well, the difference between arranged marriages and free romantic love and under bourgeois society,
yes,
is that there are different kinds of economic arrangements, but we have more illusions about the one we're with now, where people seem to freely choose one another and all of that. But he would say, no, this kind of love that we have now, as opposed to back when we did arranged marriages, this is closer to love itself, the authentic thing.
Yes, although I don't think he would want to rule out a priori the possibility that, you know, the encounter could be one that occurs through what we might, you know, standing outside of his philosophical discourse, view as more traditional as opposed to more contemporary. You know, he has said, you know, it's funny, he's one of his recent books in French, which is being translated, is entitled Éloge de l'amour, in praise of love. And therein, one of the examples he uses several times is the dating sites now, you know, eHarmony, Match.com, etc., right? And where, you know, what you have is that, you know, even though this is very contemporary for him, it's nonetheless an avoidance of leaving oneself open to the a true event at the amorous level. Because what you have is, you know, you fill out, as of course everyone knows more or less how these things work, even if you haven't used one yourself, you know, you provide this list of preferences and criteria. And, you know, it's a matter of, okay, the system with its algorithms is going to select for you a possible partner who fits this description that you've given, right? And where there's a match in the sense of your two descriptions overlap enough. And this is, of course, a form of arrangement. It's say, okay, well, in advance, I have, you know, these tastes and these requirements, and I want to find an object, you know, whatever object it is, whatever individual empirical flesh and blood person is the fungible X that fits in that slot, I want that to be lined up for me. And of course, you know, Badiou does have a sense that there's something there that we could call perhaps inauthentic, but it's inauthentic in a very precise sense, right? It is, I don't want to be open to the new that I can't imagine in terms of an encounter with someone that I would not predict would spark this sense of commitment or fidelity. I want what I already know I like, and I want it in a certain form delivered to me, you know, in a way I can control, right? Yeah.
Welcome back to the dating game, and it's time to meet our young lady for game number one, and here she is. Oh, boy. This dazzling bachelorette is a chronic disco dancer. She's here tonight to answer the musical question, can the hustle really clear up the stress in the lower tract? She's a model, a magician, and a real pussycat. Welcome, if you will, Miss Patrice Burke. Hello. Meow.
Meow.
Born under the sign of Leo? No. You know there are three bachelors over there, and you ask them anything you like except their name, age, occupation, or income, and then when you figure out, after it's all over, which one you want, you've got a date, okay?
Okay.
All right, we'll start with a hello from bachelor number one. Number one, would you say hi to Patrice, please?
How you doing, Patrice?
How about number two?
How you doing today, Patrice?
And number three?
Hello, Patrice.
Okay.
Are you ready for this?
I think I am.
Got your questions all set?
Yeah.
Okay, have a seat right here. Make yourself comfortable. And good luck, Patrice. Here we go.
Bachelor number three. It's the holiday season, and I'm Santa. You're on my lap. Little boy, take it away.
What? Wait a minute. Wait. I don't know what she looked like. Could I see what she looked like?
No, you can't. You can't, number three. No.
Just, oh, all right.
That's part of the game. You just have to stay there and answer as best you can.
But I don't know who she is.
No, I know. But
I'm Santa.
Imagine she's beautiful.
Yeah?
I'm Santa. And
Santa Claus?
Right.
But you don't sound like Santa Claus.
Okay.
Pretend.
Pretend.
Pretend. Yes. You're on her lap. Take it from there.
And what do I do?
That's what I want you to tell me.
I'm going to tell you what I want for Christmas.
Oh. Yes.
What?
What?
Oh, I want for Christmas television and record player and record food.
Okay. You were a good boy all year and you think you deserve it?
What?
Were you a good boy all year and you think you deserve all those?
Yes.
Okay.
To decide on her date. No, number three, no. We'll take time out for these good words.
I'm very, very thirsty.
Thirsty, my dear? How about some imitation citrus-flavored carbonated beverage?
But I want the real thing.
I have what you want, darling. No sugar added, Wink. Wink has real grapefruit, oranges, limes. Wink's fruit flavor is real everything. Imitation, nothing.
Let's have a party.
Wink really has a feel, cause the fresh fruit flavor of Wink is real.
Back to the dating game. And Patrice, we've reached that moment now when you have to tell us which one of those three wonderful fellas over there gets the date. Will it be bachelor number one, bachelor number two, or bachelor number three? Which one are you going to choose?
Bachelor number one.
Number one. All right. Congratulations. Why number one? Anything about number one?
Oh, I like his baby story.
You like his story of babies from coconuts and bananas and all that? All right. Parcel post. Now, before you meet him, let's meet the other two bachelors. They did a great job. Bachelor number two loves to play hockey. Number two is a lucky gambler, although he didn't get so lucky tonight. He's an engineer. Say hi to George Schauer. George, come on and say hello, please. Sorry, George. Would have been nice, but you didn't get the day. You also didn't choose bachelor number three. I must tell you this, bachelor number three did not seem to know the rules. He was a last-minute replacement on the show. Bachelor number three didn't show up, so we just found him out in the street, and it was very nice of him to come in. Baji, no. Kimran, Baji, come on and say hello, please.
You mean I did not win? No. I did not, no.
Come on, Bart.
No, I won.
No.
No, I won. But I won. I won.
No, you didn't.
But I answered all the questions right.
No, Patrice didn't choose you, Bart.
But I answered all the questions the right way.
Come on over, Bart.
No.
She'll give you a kiss.
No. I did not lose. I want it.
He doesn't want to meet you. Let me tell you something about the bachelor. Oh, here he comes. Come on, Baj. Oh, give him a hand. Did a great job.
I the questions the right way.
There is no rights, you see.
But I was honest about it all.
I know you were.
I want the, I want
especially,
sure
I like the one about wanting food for Christmas. I like that. But, Baj, I'm sorry you weren't sure. We do have some gifts for you. We have prizes, okay? Okay? No, don't be too bad. Maybe you can come back. Would you like to see him come back again, folks? You come back. All right. Thank you, Bob. Maybe come back and join us again, okay? Go rest. You can go now. That's it. No, Bob. No, that's it. I'm sorry. I've never quite seen anybody take it quite that hard.
Well, that just about wraps up the first part of this two-part conversation about Zizek, Badu, and political transformation. Next week will be part two with Professor Adrian Johnston. And I may invite my son Benjamin on the show in order to make an attempt to explain the idea of events and acts to him using movie references. If I can do that, then I'll be confident that I have some understanding of the ideas myself. The music and clips in this episode included the YouTube star Barton Buster playing We'll Meet Again on the organ, as well as Zizek eating lunch and talking about communism, Bill and Ted finding something strange afoot at the Circle K, an advertisement circa 1970 for Wink Grapefruit Soda, and Andy Kaufman not quite playing along with the dating game. Right now you're hearing the Kronos Quartet play the Star Spangled Banner. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to this week's Titanic Factoid.
Aboard ships in 1912 was quite new, so there was by and large no set procedure for handling the messages that came in on the Titanic, or any other ship for that matter, unless the message was specifically addressed to the captain. Otherwise, the two gentlemen working the wireless, Phillips and Bride, took care of anything as best they could. They also took care of outgoing messages, and that was actually most of their work. Passengers would pay to send messages to friends and family, things such as having a wonderful time, wish you were here. The work did get piled up, and sometimes important traffic information didn't get to the needed place. The Titanic's wireless was brand new. It was 1.5 kilowatts. It was powerful for its day and relatively long-ranged. But it was still a lot of work handling all of the messages that were coming and going, and over the course of April 14th, quite a number of messages about icebergs in the North Atlantic came in, but these ended up in various places. One did get plotted on the chart that they had for that very purpose. One ended up in the pocket of Bruce Ismay. Captain Smith had one or two. They were not all in one place. They were sort of scattered about the ship, and a clear picture of how much ice was there was not really available. If they had plotted it, they would have seen that there was an immense ice belt 78 miles wide right across the Titanic's projected course. Now, by mid-afternoon on the 14th, the Titanic's wireless set went on the blink, and Phillips had to spend the next 4 hours trying to find out what was wrong with it and making repairs. And this was frustrating because the wireless traffic just kept on piling up, and there was a large backlog of work to do once the set was finally fixed. So just a little past 7 p.m., he got it working, and he started once again to try to get these messages out and take messages in. And at 7:30, the Californian called to warn the Titanic about three large bergs that were 5 miles to southward of us and gave the position. And this was ice only 50 miles ahead of the Titanic. And the lack of any real protocol about how to handle the wireless messages made it so that no one really even noticed the proximity of the icebergs until it was too late.